call the answer line, where you're the head honcho, the big cheese, top dog, big man, mighty boss. And you can tell us exactly where to go.
Hello, this is Jonathan Marks for PCJ Online. Just about to push the button on another program from the media network Vintage Radio Archives.
Media Network, the weekly communications magazine for shortwave listeners. Produced and presented by Jonathan Marks.
Hello, and there's an abundance of new books in today's program, plus the answers to our recent competition. But let's start with an odd observation up on 21 megahertz. You may know that the 15-meter amateur radio band runs between 21,000 and 21,450 kilohertz. An amateur radio enthusiast tend to be rather possessive of their allotted space. But this past week, the Voice of Greece in Athens has decided to move inside that amateur band by selecting not 21,455 kilohertz, as I said earlier today. A lot of people have caught me out on that. But instead, 21,445 kilohertz. 21,445, with some success at 0940 UTC.
This is Athens. You are listening to the Voice of Greece. Here is the news in English.
And there's another kind of battle going on, albeit a peaceful one, in South America. Here's Bob Chaundy.
The Catholic Church in Ecuador has decided to make its voice more prominent by stepping up the power of its shortwave operations on 5055 kilohertz. Reports indicate that the reason is to reach more than just a section of the Ecuadorian population with the message of Catholicism. Radio Católica del Ecuador now hopes to reach listeners in neighbouring countries. Observers in the region indicate that this move may have been influenced by the success of the shortwave evangelical station, HCJB, also based in Quito, which still remains as a much more powerful operation despite this latest move. Radio Norway International is progressing with its plans for a third shortwave transmitting site in the country, now that government plans have been approved for the first stage of construction. A 500-kilowatt transmitter and three antennas are being installed at a place called Sveo on the Norwegian coast. It will come on the air towards the end of 1986, with broadcasts to Central and North America. When fully completed in 4 years' time, the new site will have three 500-kilowatt transmitters and six antennas. It remains to be seen whether these extra facilities, which will considerably improve the technical capabilities of Radio Norway International, will mean an expansion of English language programming to more than a weekly program on Sundays.
Nearly a month ago, we concluded our series of reports about events at the World Administrative Radio Conference in Geneva, Switzerland, convened to at least start the process to put some order back into the present free-for-all broadcasting chaos on the shortwave broadcasting bands. Well, everyone packed up and went home after 10 grueling weeks, which everyone agreed was exhausting. One of the solutions to be drawn up was to look at ways in which the computer could help make the shortwave bands more ordered. Indeed, there was a proposal that the International Frequency Registration Board in Geneva should plan the bands, rather than the national PTT administrations at the moment. Jim Vastenhout, who's engineering consultant to Radio Netherlands Management, was one of the delegates to WARC, and I asked him what work has now started in Geneva leading up to the second part of the conference in 1986, and to explain the two ways in which the computer will be used.
One is as a frequency prediction system. The computer will determine the frequency that is best for propagation, and it will also predict the availability in time. We call it the reliability of the circuit.
So that means how often you'll get through with a good signal.
Right, and if you don't come through with one frequency, you might get another one allotted to you by the computer. So that is one, I think, good purpose of the computer. The whole world has decided that they have adopted this prediction method, so here we go. Now, the second use of the computer is, simply said, you drop in all the frequencies, all the requirements, all the program requirements that people have into the top of the computer, and at the bottom come out all the frequencies arranged in the right order for minimum interference.
It sounds very simple, but has that program actually been put together?
That is the problem. The computer program has not been put together at all. We need extensive studies by software specialists and by HF planning people in order to come to a good, realistic planning method.
But don't some countries see the computer as a magic solution, say, for the jamming or deliberate interference on the bands? Because I doubt if any computer program is going to allow Western broadcasters, such as the BBC or Voice of America, to use a large number of frequencies, up to sometimes 20 at the same time, for broadcasts which are jammed, and therefore they feel they need to use these frequencies. If the computer says they're only going to get 4 frequencies in future to serve this target area, what happens then?
That is a big question, but the computer will allow or allot only a certain number of frequency per program, per service area. But if you have interference of any kind, you are allowed to have what they call a quick consultation procedure with the IFRB in Geneva in order to sort out the problems.
Well, this brings me to another point. Can WARC 86 really succeed? After all the countries who have the expertise to solve the problems stand to lose in any solutions. There's not much incentive for people to step forward and work hard against their own national interests.
Yes, I think that the current adopted planning method is to the disadvantage of the big users. We do not know the amount of harm that is being done to the big broadcasters by the adoption of this planning method. The experts will find out, certainly, during the intercessional period between now and 1986.
How many people are actually working on this problem now? Because you mentioned that some 600 delegates were in Geneva.
Yes, there has been a circular letter from the IFRB or the ITU asking for support by sending specialists on software. I suppose that maybe 20 to 25 people will be work full-time on this project for the coming years.
Another conclusion of the conference, which seems to have got wide publicity, is the suggested changeover from conventional double sideband broadcasts, or AM, such as the one you're listening to now, to single sideband instead. But surely it's a bit too soon to say that the future is all sorted out.
That's right as well. It has been determined that the transition period, which will last for 20 years, will be discussed and will be settled at the second part of the conference, that is in 1986. It means that after a certain amount of time, no transmitters for double sideband will be installed anymore. In that time, all the receivers must be suitable for single sideband. Now, the receiver lifetime can be estimated at about 10 years. And of course, as soon as manufacturers know that SSB is going to come, they will start to develop and produce those receivers. So we expect that as soon as the transition period starts, there will be an active market for new receiver types, improved receiver types, and we will in fact enjoy the full benefit of SSB, that is twice the number of stations in the same amount of frequency space, in 10 years instead of 20.
But is there any advantage as far as the broadcaster is concerned in going into a single sideband? After all, it costs a lot of money to keep a 500 kilowatt AM transmitter on the air at the moment, or a number of them. Can you cut your energy costs by going to SSB?
One can consider two types of single sideband. In the initial stage of the transition period, you have single sideband with a 6 decibel reduced carrier power. This means that it can be received with a normal DSB receiver.
The one that people are listening to now, for example.
Right, yes. This type of transmitter is not more cost-effective, neither is it less to operate it. But after the SSB receivers have been introduced into the market, you can operate transmitters with 12 dB carrier reduction. They are cheaper to acquire, about half the price of a standard double sideband transmitter, and they are about a quarter of the costs to run.
Now let's move to the telephone. Okay, this call reached Hilversum 18700 on Friday. Stare at the phone and wait for
your reply. Hello, this is Jos Bertels speaking from Hasselt in Belgium. The radio ship Communicator is back on the air after nearly 2 weeks absence. The frequency seems still to be the same, so 729 kilohertz. I heard it this afternoon from 14:30 till 14:45 UTC with only a carrier test. I heard also the usual laser effect, like a pew pew pew, at approximately 16:45 UTC. The signal strength was almost the same as their last test 2 weeks ago.
Thanks for the call. Well, if Laser 730 ever lose their special effects tape, they'll know who to contact. And in fact, tests were heard again on Sunday. Since then, silence. The saga continues. Well, it is an answering machine. Let's return to that phone.
Hello, this is Roger Tidy in London, England. Just ringing up to tell you about a new Libyan radio service. Libya has a new English language service beamed to Africa. It's called The Voice of Africa. And I first spotted this station on Sunday, March the 4th, at 1900 hours UTC on a frequency of 15450 kilohertz. No sign of the station the next day, Monday, March the 5th, but today, Tuesday, March the 6th, the station was heard again at 1900 UTC. The address for this station, The Voice of Africa, or rather for this service, is The Voice of Africa, Post Office Box 333 in Tripoli. Voice of Africa, Post Office Box 333 in Tripoli.
Thanks. Well, following that call, we listened last night, Wednesday, at 19 hours UTC, but heard nothing on 15450 kilohertz here in Hilversum, maybe due to bad propagation. If Libya has started a Voice of Africa service, that's interesting, because Egypt has had a Voice of Africa from Cairo program for many years. Is one trying to be confused with the other?
The trouble with shortwave radios is simply finding them. It's no good looking in the department store.
Short what? No, we don't have much call for that nowadays. They use microwaves in kitchens now, don't they?
And when you find the radio store, there's absolutely no guarantee that the dealer isn't trying to swamp you with technical jargon.
No, this piece of electronic genius is not rubbish. Would I try and have you on? Look at the features. On-off switch, volume control, analog dial. None of this digital claptrap which could break down when you're out in the wild. SSB, that simulated stereo beacon. Plus, totally ineffective image suppression. So you get twice as many signals on the radio than with any other conventional set. Now, what do you say?
If those specifications sound impressive, you'd better get hold of the latest edition of the Receiver Shopping List published this week and find out what's really on the market. In 24 pages, we've listed most of the shortwave receivers on the world market between about $60 and $2,000. Our last edition was back in March of 1983. Since then, 18 new shortwave receivers have appeared, so we felt it was about time to update the data. The consumer publication includes details of specialist receivers, such as those with channel selection instead of conventional frequency readout, a look at whether tax-free really means what it says, and addresses for further information. The Radio Netherlands Receiver Shopping List, edition number 7, is free of charge on request by writing to Media Network, Radio Netherlands, Box 222, Hilversum, the Netherlands.
Excuse me, but your credit card's expired. But we do take cash.
Now back to African media news. And our reporter, Richard Jinbe, has noticed a change in policy in the Republic of South Africa. Normally, most programmes, apart from English and Afrikaans, are broadcast on VHF FM, restricting coverage of both South African programmes and reception of competitive broadcasts from over the border.
In an unusual move, the SABC has put two of their black radio services onto medium wave from their sites near Pietersburg in the northern Transvaal. That's Radio Venda on 864 kHz and Radio Tsonga on 990 kHz. Both are 5 kilowatts and both operate 24 hours a day. Another station that has only recently begun operating around the clock is Radio Nacional de Angola. All it means is they've added an extra 3 hours to their schedule, 0100 to 0400 hours UTC. In the 25-meter band, Luanda has been noted drifting from 11955 to a lower channel, 11830 kHz. Frequency drifts are the order of the day because Radio Botswana is at it as well. Their nominal frequency, 4848 kHz, is often not to be found. Instead, I've located them on 94948 or 4797 kHz. So that's 4948 or 4797. In other news, Japan's Nippon Electric Company is to supply Ghana with three new transmitters. But the report does not indicate whether for domestic or external use, nor the type of power involved. And in Zimbabwe, the government has said it may retaliate against South Africa for its Radio Truth broadcasts, which it claims are transmitted from a station in the northern Transvaal. The implication seems to be that Harare might be planning a propaganda radio station of its own.
It was about a year ago that we first reported about that clandestine station, Radio Truth. And if anyone wants to write us university thesis about clandestine radio propaganda, a visit to Southern Africa would seem to be in order. Radio Truth starts innocently enough.
Good morning, and welcome to another programme from the English Language Service of Radio Truth.
But the rest sounds rather like a Tokyo Rose or Argentine Annie's style of transmission, mixing in intelligence reports with a barrage of sarcasm.
We told you some time ago that the 5th Brigade is being retrained at Inyanga Barracks by the British military training team. However, so that the noses of our great allies, the North Koreans, are not put out of joint, retraining is definitely not the term being used anymore. In fact, such is the fear that we might offend Kim Il-sung and his slant-eyed henchmen that the fabulous Fifth is only being trained...
What a strange world we live in.
Media Network's Book Review.
Well, a number of books came in this week, which is rather unusual, plus some phone calls saying, what's going on? In November, we mentioned a forthcoming publication called Radio Database International, which was going to be a new style frequency guide for the shortwave listener. You may have subsequently seen advertisements for it, giving the address of Gilfer Shortwave in New Jersey, USA. Well, as from next week, Gilfer is intending to return the money to those who've ordered the book. Oliver Ferrell of Gilfer told us on Tuesday that he doesn't have a product to sell, since the editor hasn't met their deadlines. Well, Larry Magny is the editor of the book. He's on the line from Pennsylvania, USA now. So, Larry, why are people getting their money back from Gilfer?
Well, we had hoped to reach agreement with them concerning distribution, since our field of expertise has really never been distribution. We're into monitoring and now into publishing, so... We tried to reach agreement with them on this issue, and after a great deal of time and negotiations, it did not succeed. So we scuttled the winter-spring edition because there was no time and no way we could distribute it without them.
But you're now talking about two distinct publications, because we have received one of them, the Radio Database International Tropical Band Survey.
That's correct. The Tropical Band Survey is... applicable pretty much throughout 1984, but the international band data, of course, would be out of date in 4 months because the summer changes would be in effect by then, and of course our book would be out. But we're going to issue the international material in the summer and autumn when it will be fresh for the full 6 months. When people will get their refund check or any other evidence of having ordered the winter spring edition from Gilfer, since these people showed faith in us and our project, we will give them a complimentary copy, and at no charge for postage or anything else, of the tropical band's position.
Well, let's have a look at this tropical band survey. It's a 44-page, softcover A4-size book, professionally printed and laid out. And the heart of the matter is a graphical representation of the shortwave spectrum between 2260 and 5707 kilohertz. If you've seen the bar charts used in programme schedules by the BBC or Radio Australia, you'll understand what I mean. Along the top of the page is a scale representing the time in UTC. Down the side are the frequencies. So you can select 2420 kHz, for example, and read off that Radio São Carlos is noted between fade-in at 1945 UTC and sign-off at 0300. Details of the power and target area are also easily at hand. Monitoring reports have been used to compile the survey, which also indicates which of seven languages was monitored. So how much does it cost?
The RDI will be available, the Tropical Bands Edition, will be available until June 25th for $3.95 postpaid anywhere in the world. And if persons outside North America wish to have it by air, it would be an additional $2 on top of the $3.95. After June 25th, we will begin charging 85 cents additional for postage and handling.
Larry, this tropical band survey comes out at 44 pages. How big is the June edition going to be? Because that's the international section.
We see that somewhere in the low 200-page region, Jonathan, about 220, 240 pages.
And how much is that going to cost?
That will be $9.95.
Overall, we find the book easy to use. There are minor criticisms, though. A few obvious terms like AM are not defined in the introduction. And the propagation prediction data, valid only until April at the back of the book, is a bit difficult to read off accurately. How do you react to those points, Larry?
That sort of criticism is more than welcome, Jonathan, because we're trying to improve with every edition. And your comment concerning the AM mode has already been noted and will be included in our glossary that you may have noticed we already have a glossary in there. And we will add any terms that people feel are appropriate to make it clearer. As to the graphics in the rear, these graphics, of course, are a new type of predictions for the shortwave propagation situation. In the past, the shortwave propagation charts have consisted of a number of squiggly lines and have been rather difficult to decipher for the layman. So we've converted this into a probability chart in which the highest probability of reception is black and the least probability of reception is white. And the points in between are, of course, various scales of gray. Now, what you see there is almost a prototype. It's on an experimental system being done on a home computer by Professor Meisel, who's developing the system. And what we're looking for is feedback from listeners as to how they like the presentation, how accurate they feel it is. And at that point, we will reprogram the entire system in an advanced language, put it on our main machine and our main printer, and put it out with a great deal of high resolution as opposed to what you see now.
The summer-autumn edition, as well as giving the frequency information, looks as though it's going to cover some articles as well, because you mentioned that you're going to be reviewing shortwave receiver equipment. Is that along the lines of what's happening now in the World Radio TV Handbook?
Not really, Jonathan. We have made it a point throughout this project to complement or be different, if you wish, from what is in the handbook, because after all, if people want material of that sort, it's very well served already in the World Radio TV handbook. The same thing applies, of course, to the receiver reviews. We will be doing these on a more technical level, relying on some lab tests that we have developed over the years in concert with Sherwood Engineering, and in turn, we hope to have a fairly sophisticated level of equipment reviews that could not exist in the past.
Radio Database International can be reached at Box 300, Penns Park, Pennsylvania, USA, and the zip code is 18943. And those new details have been added to our Radio Netherlands book list. Also included are details of a new listening guide with similar graphics format that's come out of Japan, though this comes in a photocopied loose-leaf format, and it's a very specialised publication. It's called the USSR DXing Handbook, and it features 80 pages of schedules, maps, programme details, and identification hints for those planning to explore the regions of the Soviet Union, on the receiver dial, that is. This group have obviously researched their facts very well, and the use of a home computer has ensured that changes made as late as last month are in this handbook. It costs $6 airmail anywhere in the world, and the address for further information is USSR DXing Circle, P.O. Box 14, Gifu Kita, that's G-I-F-U-K-I-T-A, Gifu Kita, 502 in Japan. Joining me now is Hans Backhausen of our Frequency Bureau, because a small paperback pocketbook has been published in the United Kingdom by Bernard Barbany Limited, called 25 Simple Shortwave Broadcast Band Aerials. The author is American Ed Knoll, and with 64 pages and a host of diagrams, it looks quite useful. But Hans, I normally associate antenna booklets with a university degree in mathematics, because there's a lot of theory in getting an antenna to function properly. What about this book?
Yes. Well, you're right, Jonathan. Aerials is a vast subject, but Mr. Ed Knoll's intention has been to give only practical, easy-to-construct designs, offering the best performance at a very low price.
But is there any theory at all? Because it does say simple in the title.
Well, complex theories and mathematics have been avoided, but that doesn't mean that you can read it without having any understanding of aerials. One should know something about wavelength in free space and parasitic reflectors, for instance.
I see, so it's beyond the purely non-technical people.
I wouldn't call it a book aimed at beginners. There is a range of 25 antennas from the very simple quarter wavelength vertical ranging to the more complex array of three verticals.
But do you really need all that these days? I mean, most of the advice in the handbooks that come with shortwave receivers say stick a piece of wire in the back of the receiver and that should do. Do you need all these special antennas?
Well, if you want to get more gain out of your antenna, you definitely need a more complex antenna like an array. The only problem is that an antenna like that will be well beyond the reach of a city dweller.
Indeed. I noticed some of these antennas are something in the region of 50 foot long.
Yeah, that's right. To me, being a Dutchman, it was a bit annoying having to convert all those dimensions in feet into meters. Well, it indicates that this booklet is mainly aimed at the Anglo-Saxon public. One further indication for that is that 6 pages of tables have been spent to a conversion from UTC, Coordinated Universal Time, to local time, covering all time zones in the United States, Canada, Australia and New Zealand.
Are the parts to build these antennas easy to get hold of?
Well, he only uses low-cost materials like PVC piping, nylon rope, even carpet tacks.
So it's a sort of experimenter's book.
That's right.
So overall, I mean, its price is pretty low. It's £1.95 in the United Kingdom. What do you think of it?
It gives a lot of information about easy-to-construct aerials, and considering the fact that it costs only about $3, I would say that it's certainly useful and recommendable.
Media Quiz 84.
Well, Pete Myers, the voice behind that jingle there, unfortunately is in India at the moment, enjoying himself, so I've dragged in Bob Chondi to help us with this next item.
Dragged? How dare you? Well, we delayed the announcement of the winners of our media quiz by 14 days to allow entries from our Indian postbox to reach us. Well, let's have the questions first. Which station carried test programmes during 1983 on behalf of other shortwave broadcasting organisations in the Far East and Central Europe?
Well, the answer was Africa Number 1, which relayed Radio Japan and Swiss Radio International.
Next one, number 2. What is the name of the radio vessel whose broadcasts may have gone with the wind?
Well, we were thinking of the ship Communicator after that fiasco in the North Sea with the helium balloon antennas.
That's when the antennas got lifted up the boat, did it?
That's right, they blew away.
Number 3. Which organisation in Switzerland obtains airtime a few times a month to conduct test transmissions in various languages?
The answer there was the Red Cross, of course.
Number 4. Where are the headquarters of a major international broadcasting station planning 5 new relay stations by 1990?
The answer was Washington, D.C., of course, the headquarters of the Voice of America.
Now, if you take the first letter of each answer, play around a bit, you get WARC, standing for World Administrative Radio Conference. Number two got a lot of people worried, but still 318 people got it right. And I've pulled these names out of the bag. First, the four runners-up who get a copy of the 1984 World Radio TV Handbook. Sachin Agshikar, who lives in Bombay, India. Guan Hock Ong, who lives in Malacca in Malaysia. Richard Hunt of Tadcaster in England. And Robert Sivers of Nlangano, Swaziland. And the top prize winner of the WRTH 1984, plus a subscription to the newsletter, goes to Unijoke Eniwanu, who is resident at the University of Nigeria.
Well, congratulations, Bob. You're getting your tongue around those Asian names.
I know. Well, I've had a lot of practice recently. That reminds me, don't forget to listen to Benazir Bhutto, who's our guest on Mainstream Asia tomorrow, the whole programme devoted to this quite extraordinary figure, quite charismatic figure, who, as you know, has recently been let out of Pakistan, where she's been under house arrest for the last 3 years. And she talks about how she'd like to go back to Pakistan. She tells us all about what she thinks of General Zia and how she'd like Pakistan to develop. Not to be missed.
That's at 14:30 UTC to complete the commercial. Congratulations, though, to the contest winners, and as at least 313 people turn off in disgust because they didn't win, let me thank today's contributors, and on behalf of the team, this is Jonathan Mark saying back soon. Bye for now. And that's where we end this nostalgic trip back into the Media Network audio archives from 1981 to October 2000. If you find all this stuff interesting, you might want to explore the Critical Distance website, where you can find more vintage audio shows, but also peruse recent video interviews I've made in the course of my travels around the world. Some of the videos actually follow up on points raised in the Media Network programme. So zip over to www.jonathanmarks.com for more details. In the meantime, this is Jonathan Marks saying back soon. Bye for now.